yeah, that the purpose of art being to evoke a response goes all the way back to like rock glyphs and like the cave art you find in the French cave that I can't pronounce, where they found all these ancient rock paintings.
Yeah, that's a way to show allegiances to ideas and such now as well.
Oh, yes.
So, a lot of people...
Or brands.
Like, I think when we talk about art, we get kind of stuck in the painting is what we're talking about here. Yeah. But graphic artists, illustrators, there's different mediums, there's different intents for it now.
Welcome to Worldcasting, where we discuss real, made-up things. I'm your host, Adam Bassett, UX and UI designer at Campfire Technology, game designer at Smunchy Games, and sometimes I write or draw things too. Today, we'll be discussing art and music, and how to represent or use them in your writing and world-building. Joining me today are BH Pierce, Zyvi, Sean, and our guest, LD Lewis.
Hello, I'm BH Pierce. People will be calling me Hex... or HexArc for this for the podcast. I've been a writer for the magazine since it was called World Building Monthly, and right now I handle our Ask Us Anything feature. I'm also a fantasy author, and I speak at conventions about writing and world building when I get the chance.
Hi, I'm Sean. I'm a writer for the magazine. I've been one for about 2 years now, maybe. I don't know. Time has gone weird. I'm also I also teach traditional Irish tin whistle to beginner students at my local Cultist branch, which is kind of the big Irish trad organization in Ireland. So that's kind of, I guess, my little connection to this theme. So yeah.
I'm Zyvi, also known as Opal around the Discord, and I'm editor at World Building Magazine. Also recently been working on a project with World Building Magazine and Dominican Writers Association and Cultura.com/RD to create an anthology set place in a fantasy world we've created. So yeah, I'm excited to be here and thank you guys so much for having us today.
I'm LD Lewis. I write. I edit. I'm the researcher for the LeVar Burton Reads podcast. I am one of the co-founders and the former, I guess, art director, now just lowly project manager, at the Hugo Award-winning Fire Literary Magazine. I am taking a break from running conventions and stuff to do some publishing data projects, and also actually get back to writing, because I've been a bit distracted over the last couple of years trying to stay busy through the COVID and the general sort of chaotic ennui that is our current existence. But excited to talk with art and music. which is fantastic, because fun fact, I have synesthesia. My brain kind of blends sound and color, so I'm delighted to kind of get weird about it.
I totally forgot about that note in our interview that we did for World Building Magazine. Go read it now; it's free. but yeah, that's very convenient. Also, congratulations on the Hugo Award for Faya magazine. That's a very recent thing as of the time of the recording, so that's awesome. Do you want to, I guess, while we have you here, we don't have too many Hugo Award winners on the show, do you want to talk to us about just kind of like the experience of getting nominated and winning that award, and anything along with that?
Sure. So last year, both via the magazine entity and our convention, they were both on the Hugo Ballad. The convention was on there for best related work, but we won for best semi-prosine. I was not terribly confident that we were going to get either one, because it was the experience at Worldcon, which is the convention that hosts the Hugo Awards annually, was not great from like a racist side.
That'll definitely put a sour taste in your mouth.
A little tense, a little awkward. I attended in person. Brent Lambert, who is our social media and reviews coordinator, attended in person. And we just kind of like counted the microaggressions and some of the macroaggressions. It was a really weird weekend. So by the time that Saturday rolled around, and you know, the awards were there, we were sitting there, and Michi Chota, who's one of the like a 5-time I think Hugo Award winner for her work with Uncanny Magazine, which has also just won far too many Hugos, was like holding my hand. She's like, "You're gonna get it. It's gonna be fine. It's gonna be great." She's like coaching me through the whole weekend. And I was like, "This is very sweet of you. It's very, very sweet." I don't see it happening. So like we're sitting there and it's just kind of like in the middle of this room and I've got like this gigantic red dress on, that like I stepped on repeatedly and I'm not sure how I didn't like face plant at some, like going up the stairs onto the stage. Brent was sitting next to me and then on the other side of him was Tochi Onyebuchi, who is like our new best friend somehow. Like that was like the only moment I fangirled during the entire thing. And so we're sitting there, and the lady is reading off the finalists in the category. And so, like, we're up against Uncanny, which has just, like, swept the category year after year after year. I think pretty much since, like, Faya was born. I think they won every single year since we even became a thing. I'm sitting there, and I'm just, like, I'm kind of following along with her. Like, I'm reading the things as she's saying them. And she's like, "And the winner is," and I whisper to Michi, "Uncanny Magazine." And then I just heard like the "Phi," and there was like white noise after that.
Oh no.
The room just like went up. Everyone was out of their seats. I'm still sitting there just like holding my head. I cannot believe anything that's just happened. Brent and Tochi are like sipping, like in a circle, kind of, just like right in front of me. And like Michi is up. And on the other side of Michi is John Picasso, who's like just amazing, just this like great artist who was also nominated last year. But everybody was just like really celebrating us, and I think we had a standing ovation. I couldn't see any of it because like as soon as you turn around, like it was a million people there and everybody's standing, but there's also like a spotlight in your face. To kind of like usher you onto the stage. So, yeah. And then there's like glare on my glasses and it was chaos. Finally Brent like pulls me up and we go up on stage and Brent and Tochi carry my train. Aww. Like onto the stage. I have like this long situation. I didn't know Tochi was back there until like I rewatched, like footage of the ceremony and stuff. And we get up on the stage, and Brent does his speech. We agreed that we would split speeches since we were on the ballot twice. So he wrote the one for the magazine. I wrote the one that I would have given, you know, for the convention. Brent does his speech and asks if, like, I wanted to say anything. I was like, no, because I wrote this other thing, and it doesn't make sense out of context. And I can't speak extemporaneously on this very, very bizarre moment. And then they gave us our very, very heavy trophies. And like right as Brent and I kind of like left the stage and got behind the curtain, we're both whispering. So yeah, and then like we get back out to our seats, and that was it was a very pretty cool moment.
For sure.
I'm kind of like addicted to wearing very expensive gowns now. So I end up on a ballot again. yeah, I hope I get on a ballot again, you know, so I can do some more of that. But yeah, very surreal. I think I went to bed like, immediately.
Just knocked out.
I was toasted. Like, yeah, because I paneled earlier in the day, and like carrying around the trophy was very heavy. And I changed out of my heels and wore like lower shoes, so then I was just stepping on my gown all the time. And then everybody wants to congratulate you, and I was like, I'm hot, I can't breathe, this thing is heavy. Google gave us, you know, those little like home surveillance devices or whatever, but they were free, so I took one. So like I've got this giant Google box and this very heavy trophy and a too long gown, and I'm like, no, I'm gonna go upstairs. And I knocked out immediately. I think Brent went on the balcony behind the restaurant and like kicked it with people until like 4 o'clock in the morning, and I'm like, I'm gonna leave. So
fair enough.
But it was very it was a very cool night, and I love that. I think just recently, over the last couple of days, the rest of our team that was named on the ballot actually
won the trophy.
Nice.
So it's been fun to see everyone taking pictures of their stuff, and it's, you know, it's we don't do what we do for awards, but shiny things are shiny, man.
That's very like,
I mean, you're not gonna turn it down.
So here's exactly. So yeah, that was that was a good time. 10 out of 10 would recommend.
Go get yourself a Hugo. It's a good time.
It is.
That's awesome though, and it's crazy to think too, all that happened within, like, you know, there was all that build up, but like the whole awards ceremony was like what, a minute or two, just like this huge whirlwind.
Yeah, it felt that, well, I mean, some of the speeches got a little long, and then you get kind of squirmy because you're hot and everybody was masked, so
yeah,
it was like harder than usual to breathe. But yeah, it didn't seem, I was impressed with the length of the ceremony. It didn't go on too long.
Nice. Yeah, I remember I was talking to Brent for a different interview I was doing over at Campfire. We were doing it all over emails, and he was like, I got to go to this thing over the weekend. I'll be away. I'm like, that's totally fine. Like, we're flexible, whatever. And that was toward the end of the interview. And I was just like, one of the last questions was like, is there anything else that we haven't talked about, like, that you would like to? He's like, well, we just want a Hugo.
Oh, by the way.
No, that was a very fun time to sort of see it all unfold. Like, I was following it a little bit on Twitter and all that good stuff. So yeah, it's very cool to see you guys win. I think I do want to back up very quickly and just sort of give folks who might be interested in all this kind of stuff, maybe who don't know a whole lot about FIA, do you want to give them a rundown of like what it is they do there?
So we've been around, we started in 2016 on like what, $2,000 and a website, basically. We kind of came up, we materialized after Fireside Magazine, where I am now publisher, forgot to drop that in the bio in the beginning. They released a study called the Black Specfic, or hashtag Black Specfic Report, which kind of revealed that across like 62 markets in the short SFF field, Black writers only represented about 2% of the field's publishing output. And so there was a big kerfuffle surrounding that, and that was kind of the catalyst to be like, okay, well, you know, people who are like, oh, it's just 2% because there aren't that many Black writers, or oh, they're not submitting, or they don't submit to my magazine, I publish them. So those things are happening. We're like, okay, so now we have all of these excuses out there. We're going to start a magazine. We're actually going to publish Black writers, and you will see that, you know, the quality is there. We're writing in numbers, and, you know, these excuses are not, you know, as apt as you want to think they are. So we publish quarterly, digital only, because print is very expensive. And this is our sixth year. God. Yeah, this is our sixth year. We do speculative fiction, so sci-fi, fantasy, horror, all of those little, those various umbrella genres, and it's prose, poetry. Last year we started doing nonfiction, so essays and such. We are now in our second year of paying pro rates for these things. I also author a number of the studies that kind of keep tabs on how the field is improving or not improving in terms of publication of Black writers. We sort of use ourselves as an editor kind of incubation situation. People, Black writers, or you know, people who are aspiring to certain professional positions in publishing, will come and work with us, get kind of the lay of the land, work through our systems and stuff, and kind of go off and go do other wonderful things, get agents and things. We've had a cover artist, Geneva Bowers now, sorry, who won a Hugo for her work for us in our first year. Cyan Daly, who's another one of our cover artists, was Hugo nominated with us last year and was there, finally got to meet her, which was very, very cool. So we're all about doing, I guess, the good work, and I don't know, mostly just trying to keep me out of trouble. That's pretty much my goal with any project. I'm like, I need something to do with my hands, so we're gonna offer a study. But yeah, I just handed over the keys as art director to a new director, as I did it for 5 years, and I loved it, and I'm tired. And then I took over at Fireside last year. So it's a lot of, I'm a water sign. I have a lot of fire in my life now, though. So that's weird. Yeah.
That's awesome. Thank you. Yeah, and I'll just kind of echo some of what Ella's saying. I picked up the newest issue, 21, from your website the other day, and I started reading through it a little bit. The first story in it, From Earth to Io with Love, by Adeline, is just like, holy crap. That's going to stick with me. I'm excited to finish reading it. I haven't quite had time to go through the whole thing yet, but it's a nice mix of prose and poetry and nonfiction article at the end. Definitely would recommend.
Thank you. Yeah, we do good stuff, and we're proud of all of our contributors. They, like, a lot of people, you know, we are a dream market for a lot of people, which is very special to us. So you know, people will publish with us first, and then like launch writing careers.
That's awesome.
So that's been you know, really
we've seen some in. Similar stuff here and there with World Building Magazine as well, obviously not to like the same extent. Yeah. Because we are a much smaller operation, we don't really have like marketing. but we did have one of our former editor-in-chiefs went off and started working with Paizo. We had someone go off and actually we've had a couple people go off, I think, and do like the whole editing thing that, like, after having got some experience here.
And I'm so jealous of them.
Yeah. I mean, you're on the way.
We'll see.
I mean, you're doing this whole thing with the anthology that has like,
Sorry.
No, it's fine. But like, I just want to, you know, give credit where it's due, and you're doing some cool stuff with like writing and editing and all that kind of stuff, and like administrating all this stuff. Like that's not nothing.
Well, thank you.
But we should probably start talking about the topic of today's episode.
Yeah.
The thing that was in the title, presumably.
somewhere in the footnotes, anyway.
Art and yeah, something else.
It's one of those. It's one of those art things.
Art and math.
Art and math and world building. Let's go.
Does 2 + 2 have to equal 4? Find out.
It could equal, you know,
five.
Peter Bruegel the Elder. We don't know. Okay, so I think to kind of kick us off here, I want to talk about how we can use art and music in our writing and world building. I think those kind of go hand in hand. Like, we're talking specifically about written mediums, but, you know, it could be world building for a tabletop RPG, or it could be world building for like a book, or it could be like, you know, anything kind of around those areas, which I know is broad, but, you know, you get what you pay for. One of the things that I wanted to kind of call out was how you can use art as kind of a representation of the characters. I think there's a really cool example in Jennifer Egan's A Visit from the Goon Squad, which has a lot of characters in it who are part of the music industry, and it affects the events of the story and some of the prose of it, of course. So, like, you get these really rich descriptions of, like, someone seeing a band for the first time or something like that. Listening to a demo track. And it's all presented really cool. But, like, the structure of the book itself is also, like, there's an A section and a B section, just like there's an A side and a B side, which I just thought was a really cool addition. Then there's one chapter that is a PowerPoint, which doesn't work with this analogy, but it's interesting.
I don't think I've ever seen a PowerPoint in a book before. I have to give him that.
I'll send it to you later. Look up. If I don't remember this, look up A Visit from the Goon Squad. Mm-hmm. I think it's like, what's the chapter called? Hold on, I got it right here.
This is reminding me of there was someone in my publishing course who mentioned that there was like a book that was like a hybrid between like, it was like a book I think about a webcomic author, and so it was like a series of, it was like telling the story of this author's life, which was, I think, was fictional, and then it was also interspersed with like webcomic chapters of like an ongoing story that the author had been writing within her story, and then also like blog posts. And it was like, I wish I like wrote down the name of it, but it just sounded like a really experimental and interesting style to like write alternatively, you know.
Yeah, I love that. I guess, you know, the question I kind of want to put out there is, you know, what examples have you seen of authors or, you know, creatives using art and music in their writing in a way that kind of helps elevate, like, either the characters or the situations and so on?
Yeah, I'm blanking right now because every example I can think of in like in a book or a movie where like art is a big deal, it's always a heist movie.
Heist plot. They have to steal the art from the museum.
That's valid.
I'm currently reading a book called Erewhon. And one thing that was really, really interesting to me is there's this one section of the book where the main character is walking through a fog. There's like an iceberg that's drifting into a lake in the scenery, and it's all like very haunting and beautiful. And as he's approaching, as he's walking through this fog, he finds a collection of statues with like faces that look like horrified in like some really like unsettling way. And as he walks past them, he hears this like horrifying song that sounds kind of like an organ playing, but like it's just like a eerie sound, kind of like screaming or something like that. And when he looks at the backs of the statues, he realizes that there's holes carved into their heads so that when any kind of wind blows through, the statues turn into instruments. And it's just like this, it's just such a haunting, like creeping scene, but it's like also like really beautiful. And I believe in the Gutenberg version you can find online, they actually have sheet music in the end of the chapter. It's the fifth chapter, I believe. They actually have sheet music, so that you can play the song that, that is in that scene. And I have yet to find a recording of it, and it frustrates me so much because I want to hear it so bad. but yeah, it's just like, such a cool way to like, because that's like, that's something that they come back to later on in the story as well. And it helps you understand better the culture of, because those are, statues, and the whole point of them is to scare away, I think it's like the gods of, like, ugliness or something. And it's just like a really interesting way to like kind of, because it's like a theme that he brings up a few times, like kind of foreshadows earlier, and so it's just a cool way to combine art and music, like literally like statues as art and the sound as music, into that scene and have it kind of build on itself over and over again until you better understand like the culture and like why they have such a strong negative approach to ugliness, I guess, which is like really, it's an interesting book.
Yeah, it sounds awesome, honestly. Like, it just sounds like mm-hmm. the kind of like odd but really cool world building that, you know,
yeah,
it's the kind of thing too I think you could easily like put into any setting and have a different reason for why somebody carved out these musical statues.
I'd like to bring up a way that art and music is utilized in works that are set in the real world rather than in world-built worlds, and how this way that they're usually used is a challenge for world builders. So usually when like art or music comes up, especially like high art, you know, like opera or like Renaissance paintings, they're used to show like how fancy a place is or how fancy a person is. There's that standard snippet that whenever anyone walks into like a fancy place, you hear that, like, I don't know what it's called, but it's like a cello. I'm not going to hum it because it'll sound dumb.
Do it.
But I'm sure everyone can think of. Sure everyone, don't embarrass me.
Well, that's exactly what I want to do.
I didn't want to keep up for music, so I mean, get into it.
But it's this standard snippet, and I'm sure if like we could put a recording on it, everyone would be like, oh yeah, I've seen that and I've heard that a bunch of times. It's to signify this is fancy. If someone like walks into a scene and they're looking at a painting and someone says like, ah yes, this was done by Michelangelo during, you know, X year, and it's part of this particular collection, it shows that this person is cultured. And since the audience knows that, oh, Michelangelo, Renaissance, I know that's fancy, so this person must be cultured.
Strings are good for that. Strings, woodwinds, those types of things, the sort of haughty things that wealthy people have access to.
Exactly.
You know, that aren't based on, you know, keyboards or synthesizers. Classical instruments point to, the use of classical instruments point to a certain affluence.
Exactly.
And it definitely gives you a sense of the vibe. And I think, like visual media, TV shows, I guess that would be considered audiovisual, but TV shows or whatever benefit from world building in that sense that you can't get music like that onto the page.
Yes.
It's one of those things that subconsciously fills in holes in, you know, a world that's being built.
Yeah. But one of the challenges world builders face is if you have a character walk in and then suddenly like name drop a bunch of, you know, Renaissance, like, classical composers and Renaissance artists, you know, the audience knows that, oh, that's cultured. But in something where you're writing in your old world, you in your own world, if someone comes in and drops a bunch of names, the audience is like, is that important? Is that good? They don't have, they don't have that context. So establishing that in your world is a challenge. So that in that way, we're a little bit more handicapped than people who are setting their story in the mundane world where they have all these cultural touchstones they can reference.
Yeah, but I mean, a lot of secondary worlds have some influence from our world. So like, you know, they might not have a one-to-one translation of like, you know, harp is this very fancy instrument, but like your world could have its own version of a harp. So like,
almost definitely.
I agree with you, but I think there's definitely ways to take what we know and understand here in this world and translate it through like a new lens and still kind of keep that that recognition.
It helps as well that, you know, you can always default to the old fan favorite of you taking like an important figure from our world and like just shaving off a letter or two from the name. So you've heard of Bach, but what about Ock? You know,
that's my favorite way to name him.
Like, so
you've heard of Michelangelo, but what about Michael
I had this Engel? Like crazy revelation recently where I was like, there's I don't know if you guys have heard of Arthdal Chronicles. I think I've talked about it on the podcast before, but like the land is called Arth, and like it took me a moment before I realized that Arth is literally Earth but without the E, and I was like, wait a second, mind blown.
Twilight Zone theme.
Yeah, but I mean, this all kind of like folds into a whole other conversation, which I don't think we need to spend too much time on. But basically, like, you know, it's one of those things where like if it's not broken, you know, don't fix it. Because especially like it depends a little bit too on how important that thing is to your story. So, like, if you have, I'll just go back to the harp example. If you need like a really expensive kind of like fancy high skill instrument, you could create your own and have it be part of the world that it's set in, and you know, be totally your own thing and your own creation. The question then becomes, like, all of that information is something that the reader has to remember, probably. And if it's not important to the plot or like really important to some characters, you know, is that worth spending so much time on? Like, why not just bring in a harp and say that it's like made from wood in this world? Like, yeah.
Isn't that just a theremin?
Nobody knows what a theremin is.
They're a conspiracy by Big Music to get us to buy iPods.
Oh. We're delving into the real truths here on this episode.
Welcome to Truthcasting, where we discuss real things.
Okay, wait, so back to the topic. What was the topic again? We're talking about characters and music. Was that it?
Originally, we were talking about like how we can use art and music to influence or support characters and all that, but it kind of got away from us a little bit. We can move
as is want to happen.
We can move on from that. We've got plenty of stuff written down here.
Okay, I mean, there is one other point that I think would be kind of interesting to go into. It's probably one of the more famous examples of like art and storytelling, and that is The Portrait of Dorian Gray by Oscar Wilde. And for those of you who are unfamiliar with it, the story is about a painter who falls in love with a man. And he paints a beautiful painting of him. And the man is just like, oh my god, this is amazing. And every time he goes out and comes back, the painting changes a little. And he starts to realize that every sin he commits is no longer on himself, but in the painting. And every time he ages, you don't see it on his face, but in the painting. And so everything about all of his sins, all of his evils are lifted off of himself and kept in the painting. And it's just like I don't know, I just think it's a really interesting example of using art as like a central narrative theme to go into the character.
Oh yeah, I didn't even think of that. That's
a very literal example.
Yeah, that's true. Very, very straight to the point.
Yeah, I love it. I guess kind of on a similar note with theme, I recently read Kings of the Wild, and that takes, you know, the theme of basically 80s rock and transitions it into a world of monster fighting, and sort of shows the change of how the music industry gets more about like profit and showmanship. And they're showing that in this like monster hunting world, by showing how, like, people aren't going out and hunting monsters anymore. They're, like, going out, catching them, bringing them back, and fighting them in big arenas where everyone can watch.
Oh, interesting.
It's very cool. I won't go into it too much because I think I've talked about it in another episode. But yeah, it's a very good book, and like the whole thing is just steeped.
What's the title again?
Kings of the Wild.
Kings of the Wild.
Okay. By Nicholas Eames. It's excellent. I haven't read the sequel yet. I've got that. It just came in though, so I'm gonna try to get to it soon.
It is also very good.
We'll
yeah.
see how that goes. Yeah, but it's very cool. It's like very steeped in reference to classic rock, and it really does take some jabs at the music industry, and it's just a fun story. But yeah, that one's got like music just in its bones.
If you all hear a cat, one of mine is trying to get into the room and think She thinks she's a raptor because she likes to reach for the door handle, but it's a knob. She doesn't have opposable thumbs and can't do it. But like she'll jiggle it and she'll bat at it, and then when I don't respond, she'll scream. So that's
okay. Oh, no. Well, we can't hear it, so at least I haven't noticed. Okay.
Yeah, I had to boot mine out of the room because when he hears me talking on these podcasts, he wonders why I'm not giving him attention.
I'm pretty sure that's what this is.
Yeah.
Okay, well, why don't we move on away from character and theme, and why don't we just talk about art and music in a general, like, world-building sense? So not necessarily about the characters, but maybe about the magic or the things around the characters, like the architecture. Does anybody have anything regarding all that they'd like to bring up?
There's been an anecdote I've been very excited to share.
I know. Did you enjoy my seamless transition?
Hey.
yes, I did. You're getting really good at this, Adam. So to start off with, like, currently we tend to view art as very inherently subversive. Like, artists are people that, you know, go against the grain, that they're like this, you know, that they're not separate from society, but they go their own way. They're this separate class of people who, like, you know, think differently than everyone else, and, you know, they don't, you know, adhere to what the man thinks. Yeah, as an artist, I know. Yeah. But that's a fairly modern view, because until I think about like a century or two ago, the only people that could afford art were the very, very rich and the very powerful. So they would be the ones commissioning all these pieces of art, and they'd want them to, you know, be useful to them, to make them look good and make them look powerful and you know, like full of splendor and power and all this. And I read a research paper a couple months ago about the Sutton Hoo helmet. And for those of you who don't know what that is, it was an archaeological find in Great Britain in the 1930s, where they found an intact Anglo-Saxon Viking ship burial. And there was all these intact artifacts. And one of them was a helmet that would have been worn by the person who was buried in the ship. And it wasn't just like, you know, a typical war helmet, like you unadorned. It was like fancy. It had carvings and inlaid gems and art on the panels. And it was all designed to make this person look very imposing. And this helmet really showcases the intersection between art and religion and power in one way that I thought was just so cool. So as they reconstructed this helmet that had been decayed and smashed as centuries wore on, they noticed that there were garnets, which are kind of like a more common version of a ruby, that were inlaid in several places in the helmet. And they were very small. And they noticed that there was a ring of garnet around one eye, but not the other. And they thought that was really weird. It's like, not like they would have run out of budget. Why wouldn't they it's like they would have run out of money making it. The budget ran out. They wouldn't have. Why would they do one eye and not the other? And then someone had the thought, like, well, this person probably worshipped Odin, who rather famously had one eye. So they thought there was a reference to that. But then it was almost impossible to tell that one eye was ringed with garnets and the other wasn't. So they were really puzzled about it. And then they did a bit of experimental archaeology. And they found, they built like a replica of like one of these mead halls. And they built a replica of the helmet exactly as it should have been. And they had the guy sit where the king would have sat, like at the head of it. And they lit it with fires and candle smoke and everything. And they found out that in the dim light of the fire, in the mead hall, the light would reflect off one of the eyes and not the other. So in the dim lighting, it would look like the person wearing the helmet had one eye, thereby tying him to this one-eyed god, Odin.
That is awesome.
And that just blew my mind because, I mean, think of the skill, the foresight, everything that needed to go into that. And the only reason we had that was because this one really rich guy wanted to cosplay like his god to look really cool to all his followers.
Yeah. That is pretty awesome, to be honest. I really loved that they went through all the effort there. Archaeologists are awesome.
Yeah. That's going to make a really cool scene in somebody's fantasy story.
Yes.
You're welcome. But my overall point for that rather large anecdote is that art, until like what we'd call the modern day, was made for and funded by the rich and powerful to make them look really good and really cool.
Yeah. And I think there's also...
So it was literally for the man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's also, I think, a really good takeaway there. Like, that kind of art was so ingrained in their religion.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what art in large... I don't know how that phrasing is supposed to go. That's what art in a large amount of our history has been. Not just with like that part of the world, but also like there's a whole bunch of paintings in Europe that were commissioned by the church, for example, or by pious people who wanted to be put into church scenes. I mean, I can't tell you how many versions of like the Annunciation, for example, the Medici family just kind of inserted themselves into. And like, I guess on top of that, like there's so many sculptures and masks and these references to various gods in Africa. And you've got, you know, the torii in Japan, which, you know, are a kind of architectural art themselves. It's just, there's a lot of connection between art and religion or some kind of faith, that I think in modern days doesn't get seen as often, but like for the vast amount of human history, those are the people who had money to commission these pieces of art. Or those were the things people wanted to make art of so they could feel closer to those deities or spirits or whatever they were.
Mm. Yeah, that's really interesting. I feel like I don't know if this is like a thing that everyone feels, but I feel like in US culture, there's like a very large distinction between like certain fields. So like art is its own field, STEM is its own field. And I feel like I sometimes like see that like in our culture where it's not as integrated as it could be in like our daily lives or like I just wish there was like more play between like science and art than I see like in everyday life.
It's mostly in advertising now though.
Yeah, that's true. We do see it a lot in advertising now, which is really cool. I recently...
Or depressing.
Yeah, I guess you could say it that way, too.
The apprehension in your voice when you said the word cool was just perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah, the advertising industry creeps me out because it's like billions of dollars of people sitting around going, how do we make people want things? And although, like, one of the purposes of art just in general is to evoke some kind of emotion.
Like a buying. Like
it goes all the way back to...
Like buying.
Is lying an emotion?
Buying.
Buying is the emotion of...
The impulse to purchase.
The 21st century. and the last couple.
Capitalism. But yeah, that the purpose of art being to evoke a response goes all the way back to like rock glyphs and like the cave art you find in the French cave that I can't pronounce, where they found all these ancient rock paintings. It was people do it to, you know, get a response, to make you feel.
Yeah, that's... it's a way to show allegiances to ideas and such now as well.
Oh, yes.
So, a lot of people...
Or brands.
Like, I think when we talk about art, we get kind of stuck in the painting is what we're talking about here. Yeah. But graphic artists, illustrators, there's different mediums, there's different intents for it now. So I don't know why I'm hung up on... I need this on a t-shirt. It's the Evade dog. It's this little dog who basically jumped turnstiles. I can't remember which South American country it was, but this was a few years ago.
Chile?
Yes, thank you. Protests over hiked transit costs, essentially. People who need mass transit were being priced out of it. We have a dog now who jumps turnstiles, and now Evade is all over the signage. And I'm in love with the dog, but it's one of those things where now, you know, you put it, it's art, but you put it on a button, and this is what it tells people about who you are and what you represent. So I think a lot of perhaps simpler art forms or whatever, they're geared toward less advertising, but messaging and individual identities, as opposed to, you know, supporting the coffers of the wealthy and would be influential.
Yeah, and I like bringing up that there are other forms of art besides painting. So I feel like that there's a lot of art forms that are not necessarily always recognized as art forms. Like you have, you've got like fashion. You've got I remember one. Really interesting take on art was what was it called? It was like this the Last Dragon Chronicles, and it's basically like a series of books that are about little dragons that are made out of clay, and it's about I think it's like this boy's relationship with these like little dragons that he makes, and it's just like a really interesting way of like combining art and literally breathing it to life with fire in a kiln, you know, like it's just like, there's also, you've got like quilting was like a really big theme in Bitter Blue by Kristen Kishore, where like there was a quilt that, her mother made, the main character's mother made, that was like essential to her decoding her life and her relationship with her father and her relationship with her kingdom. There's like so many different forms of art that like I feel like are so much fun to explore. Like paintings are cool and all that, and like, you know, the classic ballad that is in like the high fantasy world. But there's also like so much more different kinds of art forms out there that are about, you know, either expressing the character, expressing the world, you know, any other of those things. I feel like dance, I don't really see very often, but I think would be like a really cool, right? I'd love to see that kind of being explored more in fiction as well.
Yeah. And there's so much in our pop culture that is related to dance. Like,
yeah.
A quick glance at
TikTok.
Like, actually, yeah, TikTok. I didn't even think of that. I was going to say, like, Broadway is so steeped in dance, and, like, you have the Rockettes there, which, like, you know, isn't everyone's culture, but it is, like, it's a very prevalent part of our culture that is more and more becoming, you know, seen on TV and film.
And I feel like Netflix also had, like, a phase where it was doing like art stuff, or not art stuff, dance stuff, like what was it, the OA?
I think I missed that.
Oh, they had like a thing where they were like having interpretive dance in like their TV shows, like the OA. I don't know if you guys remember that one. It was like a story about a girl who was like she like went missing, and when she came back, she was like part of some interdimensional
classic
thing or something. I can't remember the storyline exactly, but like a big part of like I think you actually like using her skills was like the dance movements that you did that she did in order to like I think transport. I really can't remember that well. I just remember it being like a very central theme to actually using it, which is kind of interesting. Thanks for running.
Yeah. And I guess on a similar note, you know, talking about art being connected to magic, bards.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can I make
the classic bards.
Now, tell me if I'm wrong, but isn't the word bard?
It's of Gaelic origins. So
really,
okay. Yeah. I can't remember what it goes back to, but this is going to unfortunately trigger a rant I've had for a while. So I apologize. For this.
I'm so ready.
So one of the things that a lot of pop culture gets really, really, really wrong about, well, at least about the Irish situation or the Gaelic situation, is whenever someone hears the word druid, they're like, ah, that's nature magic. And if you go into the actual texts and like the stories, it's not nature magic. It's the much more cooler, in my opinion, magical rap poetry. Like, they're literally rapping, or well, not rapping, but like their whole thing is they change the world around them by telling poems and kind of singing and all this
like
stuff.
Like spoken word?
Yeah, so like one of the most famous druid scenes is kind of in the Book of Invasions. The people who will become the first Irish people, I guess, or like the main Irish people, they're coming in to shore, and they're being halted by a magical storm because the people who lived there previously are like, no, we don't want you coming and invading. We did that to the last folks. A lot of invasion in Irish mythology. It's a running theme. Yeah, strange. But yeah, so basically the main druid steps up and he sings a song to the island, convincing it to break the storm and let them land. And it's called like the Song for Ireland. I'm not going to try pronouncing the Gaelic of it because I need to see it and I don't remember it. But yeah, it's just interesting because like there's this real cultural connection with poetry and music and like mysticism connects in Gaelic culture to the point where there's like they used to have like it used to be a job to be a poet. Like that was one of the highest ranking things you could be. And a bard was actually like a slightly lower ranked version. So you had the filly who were the poets, and then you had like a little rank down, to the point where like a chieftain would sit equally beside like a filla, and that would be like they'd be on the same rank as bards. So that rant got a bit out of hand, but like there's a real connection there that you might not think of between like art and music and poetry. And like magic.
Yeah, if you could have kept the rant a little bit shorter and ended.
Oh my god.
and ended like with the whole like magical rap. I had the whole Hamilton like pulled up. I was ready to try and make so many dumb references.
I'm so
and then
sorry.
You just
oh,
kept god. Going. Do you want to do like another take of that? We roll it back a little bit.
Yeah,
just, like,
yeah.
I'll cut out all the information.
Just tell
jokes
so
for a bit.
I'll cut out all the context.
Okay, perfect, perfect.
We can just have.
Hey, I got to go on about a 1500-year-old helmet. Sean can be mad about the druids.
D&D has committed many crimes.
No, that's...
this is one of them.
No, that's okay. The extended information was worth sacrificing my stupid humor.
But it definitely the whole like. Rapping, quote unquote, to change the world around you really kind of speaks to the idea of music having power. Because, like, I can't carry a tune in the bucket. So when I hear someone sing and sound good, I'm like, what unearthly power do you have? I mean, I've been to punk concerts, and I never thought I would have jumped into a mosh pit until I was actually next to one. I'm like, well, this music is good. I guess I'm going to go beat some people up now. it has power even without like inherent magic. Horror in movies, world.
Just horror movies in general, they would not be the same without music.
Yeah.
Dun 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 dun.
I'm just imagining that scene now, but with no soundtrack, and it's just like a fish swimming.
Yeah. I mean, without John Williams' soundtrack, Star Wars isn't, I think, the classic it wound up being.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if you've... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, go on.
I was going to say, if you've ever heard me or Inky on the podcast, you know that we consume some Chinese stories. And one thing that is really interesting to me has been the use of instruments as like magical weapons, kind of like how bards do it, except in, you know, of course, in our, you know, Western version, bards are like the charismatic, like, hoo-hoo, like everyone's gonna like fuck a dragon or something. Can we fuck on this? Whoops. Anyway, but in the stories that I've been reading and watching, it's really interesting. And also, like, I don't know if anyone here plays like MMORPG, massive multiplayer online role-playing games, but there's like especially ones that are made in China, you'll often see these like magical instruments that are like usually like traditional Chinese instruments that are used as like magical weapons. So like, for example, if you are not in the role-playing games, because I don't really play MMORPGs, but for example, in The Grandmaster of Demonic Cultivation, you've got like two of the main characters both play an instrument. One is a flute, and the other is, I think it's pronounced guqin. And that is really interesting because the way they describe the music in the book, and then hearing it in the drama adaptation, first of all, Wei Wuxin, his music should be a lot more painful in the ears, but they make it very, very nice in the show, which is appreciated. it's really interesting to see how the way it's written in the story is like the... it's kind of like how people use words to conjure, you know, a spell or something. But instead they use notes, and these are like songs that are... you know, passed down through generations and secret texts and whatever, and how you can alter a song in a certain way if no one else knows the song, and like play like a something that's dangerous when you're meant to be playing something that's, you know, healing or something like that. So it's kind of interesting seeing the way that these notes and like being able to understand the songs play a role into creating tension or you know, various other instances of, you know, plot, which is really, and also skill, right? Like, how skilled are you? Like, do you need to have, like, a certain text with you to read from? Or can you, have you memorized it? Are you skilled enough to understand when a spirit is talking back to you on your instrument? Or, you know, do you need, like, a translator? Which is, like, really interesting. And it's also just, like, a trope, I think, from what I've seen, in like wuxia, is like the murderous instruments that come into play. Like in Faraway Wanderers by Priest, he's got this, I don't remember the name of it, but it's like a four-string instrument that he uses to assassinate people with. And it's just like a really, I don't know, it's interesting interplay between like music and magic that I enjoy personally, but you know, yeah. It's just me.
It's one of the we've talked about a lot of like non like painting mediums here, you know, like dance, music, costume, all that stuff. But I'd love to hear some people's takes on how to integrate that sort of thing into a written medium, into a non visual medium, because I think we've said that, you know, television has that where they can just say like, this is a painting, but. Whereas if you're doing, like, say, writing a story and you spend, like, a couple of paragraphs describing this, you know, one painting, you might lose people. But, I mean, how would some of our people integrate art into, like, a non-visual work?
I mean, I think there's a couple, I mean, obviously there's a couple different ways to go about it. In prose, you can talk about the story around the art. So mm-hmm. like you could talk about the artist and how they got to that point. You could talk about like their experience in the industry. This isn't fiction, but I think it's a good example of how that can be done. Hollywood Park by Mikkel Jolle is a really cool story about kind of how he formed the band that he ended up building a whole career on. And this, like, sort of how he got to that point, his experiences basically growing up in Sinanon, and, you know, finding music as this kind of like safe place where, you know, he could sort of exist in this place where he didn't feel totally safe. You know, putting it super simply. You also have like the example I said earlier, A Visit from the Goon Squad, that has music informing the characters and their actions, as well as like the whole formatting of the story with that A side and B side. Game of Thrones uses music in it occasionally to like showcase a part of the world building or the characters. You know, you have The Bear and the Maiden Fair, which people might be most familiar with from that one episode on the show that had it, but that was originally like mentioned in the books. You have the Reigns of Castamere, which becomes like this anthem for you know, one of the houses. And you know, I think there's a lot of different ways to approach it. Poetry and anything poetic has an advantage of rhyme and meter. So I think it depends a lot on like what you're writing and how you're doing it. Also what your goals are. Like you could integrate art as like the background of that art into what you're talking about without necessarily like having to write the music or have anything like extensive like that. So yeah, I think there's a lot of different ways to do it. It's not necessarily an easy thing to do. And it's not always something that we remember to do, which is one of the reasons I wanted to do this episode, because like nobody thinks about, at least nobody that I know, thinks about interpretive dance as like a conduit for magic or like the effects of, I don't know, the local quarry on the local architecture. You know, little things like that, which can kind of make a world richer, but often get dropped by the wayside because, you know, you're chasing some other plot.
Yeah, I think that when you're, I think when we're thinking about art, I think in terms of this question, it's kind of art as something that's separate from the history or the culture of the world that we're building. Because as I'm thinking about it, I mean, you can have the explanation of a sculpture or a statue or the contents of a painting in a room within the story. And each one of those things has a history. We don't make statues of things or people that don't matter to a culture historically. So when you're examining that on the page, that's giving you backstory into the world automatically. Same thing with pictures. I think I wrote something, there was a ship in a painting, and the story or the popular story of this ship and its exploits and its ultimate terrible demise ended up being sort of whitewashed, and then that tells you about what's happening in that culture. The people who are writing the history of this world are depicting things one way when the reality is something entirely different. So that's something that's organic to the world without it necessarily being emphasized on the page as an element of art.
Oh my god, yeah. I'm so glad you said that, because that reminds me of there's this book at the New Suns anthology, which I think I mentioned in one of my articles before, is has a story called The Virtue of Unfaithful Translations. And it's such an interesting use of art, because the whole context of the story is like, there's something that happened historically, and there's a historian that's going through all the notes and realizing things aren't exactly what they seem. It seems like everything is kind of ended peacefully on purpose. But as he's going through these texts and the paintings, looking at the historical evidence, he's realizing that what actually happened was a very intentional misunderstanding between two leaders who were hellbent on going to war with each other. And it's just like I think there was like a scene where he's breaking down the painting, and he's using the painting to describe the scene and explain like who was there and what were the important artifacts in like a certain like historical event. And that's like a, I think, a really interesting way to use art as like a kind of like a disguise for exposition.
And you can kind of going back again to the Bach arc thing. There's a really good example I found of recently in a book called Orconomics, which is kind of like a fantasy satire of a lot of things. But one of the main kind of plot points is that the heroes are sent off on a quest to recover these ancient kind of artworks. But I can't remember their exact name, but they're a reference to the Elgin marbles, which are a bunch of kind of marble artworks that are sitting in the British Museum, despite being from Greece. And it's been like a long running dispute between them, because the British Museum has a lot of stuff in it that it really shouldn't have in it. But it kind of, it's interesting because they use that angle of like the art pieces and that kind of connection to a very real world case to kind of highlight the themes of what's going on in this world and kind of like the imperialism of basically the like your generic fantasy world. But turns out that killing a lot of goblins for money does horrible, horrible things to like their culture and society. So I think that's like an interesting way that you can kind of, again, use like the very real, like the kind of real world connections that a lot of people have to art to kind of signal something without having to be explicit. Like if you never knew what the marbles were, you probably wouldn't pick up on that connection, but you still obviously get the artwork connection. But if you do, it just adds like this extra grounding of kind of horror and despair to the whole thing, because it's like, well, that happened in our world too, and we can relate through the medium art to that very directly.
Awesome. Well, I think we've got to start wrapping this up. We've been on for over an hour at this point since we started recording.
But I want to talk about Sutton Hoon.
Well,
more.
Lucky for you, we have an outro section.
I don't think that I have anything to plug apart from some mess I'll probably start later on this year. Obviously, of course, check out Fire,
well,
Literary Magazine.
If it helps, This will go out... Hold on, let me check the schedule. It's going to be a while. It takes us a while to edit and prepare these, just because...
Yeah, everyone's production schedules are so all over the place.
Yeah, and it's all, like, this is the last thing. Like, this is the lowest priority thing for everyone, because it's all volunteer. So... Yeah. Where is this one? This one will probably go out like in July, early July, maybe late June.
Cool.
So if that impacts what you would be plugging, go ahead and do that.
I don't know. Cool. So I have a short story forthcoming from Lightspeed Magazine, Last Stand of the East 12th Street Pirates. It is harrowing and stressful, so good luck with that. I don't have a release date for you yet, so maybe it's out, maybe it isn't. If this is coming out in July, FIA may also be on a ballot at some point. I don't know when they released that information either. So check us out at Fyah, FIYAH, litmag.com, and on Twitter, and now Instagram, apparently. at Violet Mag. I am also co-editing I'm co-editing the We're Here, the Best of Queer Speculative Literature, coming out sometime in the fall, most likely. I'm also dropping a number of studies in the fall. One is the latest iteration of the Black Specfic Report, and then another more massive project we're calling Inclusion in Numbers, which examines the representation of a number of demographics in traditionally published speculative fiction. God, is there anything else? If it's dropping in July, I've just done a Lammy Awards, so go check out those books. And I think that's it.
Awesome. Thank you so much for coming on again.
Thank you for having me.
God, it's both great and terrible to have so many projects.
I really should have written these down somewhere, because I only know what I'm doing based on what my calendar tells me. And so it depends on whatever that's open to. But I think I got everything.
Awesome. Well, I think Zyvie is up next. Yep.
So, again, Zyvie, also known as Opal. For my closing remarks, I just wanted to talk about really briefly. I've been I don't know if this is like a trend that's coming up or not, but something I've been noticing is this really interesting use of art and music as a way to humanize AI, which I think is like a really interesting application of it. You can see it in several short stories. One of them is from Faya. It's the Trumpet Player by Nicole Givens Kurtz.
Yeah.
Is the use of jazz music as a way of kind of exploring the humanity, as we would call it, of these robots, and kind of like showing how like you can have music, which can be considered like soul, you know, to some people, you know, like that's the soul of a person is their artisticness or something like that. And then there's also but the final performance of The Amazing Ralphie, which was recently featured on LaBarber and Reed's by Pat Cadigan. Oh, it's so good.
That was one of my picks. I was very happy.
Hey, congrats. Yeah, it's just a really interesting story about this this AI that uses I would consider it like digital art in order to help someone on their way to death, like out the door, trying to like ease them into like a beautiful transition into death, which is felt very humanizing in a way of the AI, like showing that compassion through the art of their technology. And Words We Say Instead by Britt E.B. Hive, which I think was also featured on LaBarber and Reed's. And that one, yeah.
And I did that one, too.
Oh, wow. Okay,
it's always,
cool.
It's always so fun to just be like, my hands are in everything. You're welcome.
Yeah, thank you for bringing these stories to light.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because this one was like another interesting one with AI where the ship and the captain, we see the humanity within the ship through the captain's like lullabies and through the story, the ship's interaction with music, kind of like making the AI feel like a child to us. And it's I just think it's a really interesting use of music and art to help bring a sense of humanity or empathy for these creatures that we often detach from humanity. So, you know, you often hear people are like, oh, so what if AI are taking over, you know, automated tasks? They'll never get the heart of humanity. And these stories are kind of like contradicting that, like, well, maybe they can, and maybe we should empathize with them. Maybe we should be treating AI as something that's so foreign and inherently evil just because it doesn't have that element of humanity to it. I don't know. I haven't fully thought out this thought, but there's like a lot that I want to like pull from and kind of like munch on for thought later on. So just, you know, look out for that. Look out for those kinds of stories because they're kind of interesting and I'd love to see more of them. Ow.
Did you want to plug the anthology before you?
Once again, we are the World Building Magazine is working with Dominican Writers Association and Cultura Comics RD to bring to life an anthology that takes place in one setting. So it's a collection of stories written by different creators, both writers and artists, in the setting of an island called Quislaona. And it's going to be really cool. And I'm super looking forward to having it come out, going through the submissions now, right? And it's been a lot of fun. And Hex was there for part of that development. Thank you so much, Hex. And looking forward to it. So
my contribution was looking at a document and asking like four questions.
and also for supporting me, because I was like fully expecting people to be like, no, what are you talking about? Like, focus on doing this. And Adam's like, yeah, go for it. I was like, what? Okay, cool.
that was one of those things. I think I was, I might have been editor in chief at the magazine at the time. And it was one of those things where it's like, I don't got time for this, but if you do, yeah, sure, we'll slap our name on it. I trust you.
Thank you.
That's Adam, all right. I don't got time for this, you do it.
Yeah, that's one of those rare moments for me. Even now that I'm not editor-in-chief, I have gotten sucked back into some things here, but it is what it is. Like this podcast. Although I want this podcast. There's some other stuff that I've gotten sucked into where it's like, I'm going to just be a fly on the wall and be here because some people want me here for some reason.
Never leave. Please never leave. if I could shout out one more thing. You can obviously cut it out if it ends up being too long of an outro.
We've had episodes that are like 2 hours long in some cases.
Oh, God.
Like, that was a mistake, but it happened.
If there's a listener out there who's like, oh, God, please shut up. I'm so sorry. I'm just going to go for it anyway. If you've read some of my articles, you might know that I'm a huge fan of Power and Magic Press. They recently released an anthology called Mañana. It's a graphic novel anthology. And if you want to see like the intersection of art and storytelling, there's several stories in the anthology that do so, either with dance, with architecture, with the use of designing for like carnival festivals. So that's another route too. Also, it's so beautiful. The edges of the pages are iridescent rainbow. It looks metallic. Ooh. It's so cool. Just throwing them out there because I always love what they do.
So I guess if I'd have any one closing thought, I'd kind of go back to what I've been saying all episode because I'm a one track record, is that don't be afraid to kind of look at like art and culture and music around us and just go, well, I'd like to take that, please. Thank you very much. Because there's plenty of amazing works of art and kind of connections there that you can rely on and kind of use to maybe not even to build your own things. Humans have been doing music and art for a very, very long time. We've gotten quite good at it. So I think it's always nice to be able to kind of look back at what other people have done and say, well, actually, maybe I can move this forward in my own world building to do something a bit new with it, because art is creation and retelling. I guess that would be my closing thought for the episode. I don't have much of a social media presence. I'm not nearly as talented as the other lovely people in this podcast, so not many projects going.
If you
do want to follow any of my random thoughts, you can find me on Twitter under Quivabon. You'll probably have to look in the description for that, because Irish is a great and beautiful language, but it does not play nice with English speakers at all, so apologies.
So to do my outro here, I don't think I did anything that would get on your bingo card for anyone who's listening, so I'll just mention that culture is important here, so you can get at least one space from me for this episode. Culture will influence the art the people in your world will create. I talked at length about the Sutton Hoo helmet and the one eye thing, but a much kind of bigger example is how if you look at Christian and Islamic religious art, they're very different, because with Christian art, you have a lot of scenes of, you know, saints and all these people, just people and angels and God running around doing stuff. But if you look at Islamic art, you get a lot of calligraphy and geometric images. And that's because Islam forbids graven images, I think is the proper phrase, but you're not allowed to portray these holy people. So their artists went, well, we can't do that. We're going to make our writing look really good. So people want to create art. People want to make things look beautiful. And what a people considers beautiful will very much depend on their culture. So if you want to create art in your world, first think on what the people in your world would think is beautiful, both to hear and to see, and go from there. You can find me on Twitter at bhpierce203, and you can find me on Amazon at bhpierce. I've written, as I think I said at the beginning, a fantasy novella trilogy and a full-length flintlock fantasy story. They're the Atelva Chronicles and the Rosine Rising, respectively. And that's all for me.
Cool. Thank you all again for coming by. I've really enjoyed chatting with you all about this. It sort of gives me a chance to indulge my past as someone who thought they were going to be an art teacher, didn't work out. So I guess if you'll indulge me just a moment more, you talking about some of your stuff, Hex, reminded me to remind everyone else about how art can be competitive. And by that, I mean, if we look at our own history, a lot of people are, at least, maybe not by name, but you're familiar with the Hagia Sophia, one of the most famous churches that I believe was built under the rule of Justinian in the Byzantine Empire. I'm a little hazy on some of this because I did some research on it, but it was like a few years ago. So I apologize if I get any of this wrong. But the Hagia Sophia, very big church, Justinian's rule, all that good stuff. So then the Turks came in to Constantinople, took it. It wasn't quite built right for their purposes, but they used it anyway because it was so beautiful and so large, and you know, it was there. But they kind of wanted to one-up it, because this was the largest church in the world at this point, I believe. It might still be, I'm not really sure. But basically what they decided to do was they got Sinan the Great to build the Mosque of Selim II, which was constructed to be just a little bit taller than the Hagia Sophia. It all kind of backfired a little bit because they built it on ground that was at a lower elevation, though. So technically it's not as high. But physically it is. I don't know. It's a whole thing.
I'm sure it hurt their pride.
But it's just a really interesting story about how basically one religion wanted to one-up the other religion through their architecture. It's very cool stuff to me. I guess the point of all this being is, like, there's a lot to consider when we're talking about art and all of its various forms, be that like painting, music, architecture, dance, clothing, etc. Like, there's just a million different rabbit holes you can go down. And I think the best way to do it is just to try and figure out what matters the most to your story and your setting and your characters, and how can you use these different kinds of art to support any one of those pillars. Like, maybe you're, like, if you've even got, like, your generic chosen one character, you know, maybe they are particularly good with, you know, sculpture. I don't know. And that plays into their character arc to, you know, rebuild something. So like it hints at something later in the plot. You know, you can build it into what you already have in some interesting ways, I think. And it, all it takes is really just asking the right questions and then answering them. I'm going to leave it there. If you are interested in hearing more ramblings like this, there's other episodes of this podcast. There's more of them. Did you know that? This is season 4. There's so many. We can fit so many seasons in this podcast.
That's wild.
So yeah, check them out if you're interested. We got the World Building Magazine, the magazine itself, all free to download digital off of our website, worldbuildingmagazine.com. If you enjoyed listening to any things that I specifically said, sometimes I talk on Twitter. It's at Adam C. Bassett. That's it. That's the show. Thank you for joining us, and go listen to some more so that we can have more listeners, and that makes us feel good.
Fill out your bingo cards, people.
You've been listening to the Worldcasting Podcast, an affiliate production of World Building Magazine. If you have any comments, questions, or suggestions, you can check out our website at worldbuildingmagazine.com, where you can also find links to all of our social media and our Discord server. This episode was edited by Rebecca Walker-Wayne.